The next case is number 05-1597, the Secretary of Agriculture against Omni Development Corporation. Mr. Chadwick.
You're not used to speaking first.
I'm not used to speaking first, Your Honor. I guess we'll give it that caveat. Thank you. May it please the Court. It may make sense here to begin, if you will, at the end, to talk about damages first, because the award here for the breach of a lease, in which rental payments were contemplated in exchange for office space, the award of the reversionary value of a building that was never built is simply, it's unprecedented. And in our briefs, the parties cite the same law. We don't disagree about the facts. In fact, Omni gives a block quote that we could have pulled out and put in our own brief.
Well, we have to put them in the same place they would have been but for the breach. But for the breach, the board finds there would have been an opportunity, at least, for them to finish the building. And after the expiration of your lease period of time, they would have had a building. Well, don't we have to somehow account for all of that?
First, no, it's not quite true. I mean, as this court emphasized in Wells Fargo, there are eventualities that we can, as a pragmatic matter, may believe would have occurred or not occurred but for a breach. But they're not all compensable in damages. What's compensable is the proximate effect of the breach. And so the result, in fact, the result of the breach here, based on the board's undisputed findings, is, in effect, the approximate result is that Omni saved money because it didn't have to enter into a 10-year lease that would have been a loser for Omni. So that's the approximate result, by about $20,000. So anything beyond that is simply something that Omni may have earnestly believed and may even have persuaded the board legitimately that it would have done with the lease money, with the rent payments. And that is pay off its loan, pay down the building, eventually own the equity in the building, and then do something later, a decade later. Those are all just classic other transactions and other work. It's at least one or two steps removed from the contract itself, which is your lease, that is unrecoverable. So that's with respect to damages. There are two separate claims here, though. One is for the breach damages, and one is the standing challenge to the termination for default itself. So even if we talk about breach, if the court were to find that there were no damages, there still would be an issue when the termination itself was valid. That, we suggest, can be looked at through a couple of different lenses. First one is the repudiation, the anticipatory breach by repudiation. Our argument there, again, not disagreeing with any of the specific facts found by the board, but the argument there is that Omni had a duty once the agency reasonably issued, had reasonable grounds to issue a cure notice, which is all three board members agree that there were at least reasonable grounds for that. Omni had a duty to not simply say, oh, we will complete, or promise, don't worry about it, we'll complete, we'll give you the office space, but to actually assuage the doubts with some sort of evidence, to give some reasonable basis for the agency to conclude that it would complete on time. And there's really no dispute in the record that Omni provided no new evidence at all. No financing commitment, not even evidence of real movement toward financing, and nothing.
But didn't the board examine all these facts and determine that Omni would have been able to supply assurances of financing and still complete the building on time?
The board did say that.
That there was at least the window of opportunity there.
The board did say that. In our view, the board made a couple of legal errors with respect to the legal standards that it applied. And with respect to the repudiation, not getting into the default clause itself, but the repudiation issue, the error there that we pointed out is that the board said, well, Omni said it would complete. Omni never repudiated, flat out said, we will not perform. And in the board's view, the agency had no reason not to believe that, not to believe Omni. Well, all of that doesn't add up to meeting the standard that this court, from the restatement of contracts that this court described in Danzig versus ABC. There has to be provided to the agency some reasonable basis in the response to the cure notice to conclude that there's a reasonable...
But what was that basis? The termination was at a stage in the proceedings where nothing would have happened anyway.
Well, Omni was at approximately 2 weeks from its scheduled start date of construction. It had been saying, it had said...
But that had been changed along the way?
It had been changed, but as recently as the prior month, in May of 97, Omni had stated that it would stick to that schedule, that it planned to start in July. Now, in mid-June, the response to the cure notices was, well, actually, we're not going to make that, but we're still working on that financing. We promise you, we're going to do it. We're going to complete. And that simply was not evidence at all. And once you have the agreed premise that there was a valid basis for a cure notice, and if the response to the cure notice is essentially insubstantial, just consists of promises and the like, that satisfies the objective standard for a breach by repudiation. With respect to the termination for default clause, the invocation of that clause, there's a threshold error here by the board that we pointed out, that the board, apparently misreading this court's precedents, because it did cite a bunch of them, refused to look at and include in its analysis certain evidence that existed at the time of the termination, but simply wasn't known to the agency until later, until the agency got into discovery of the board. And that has to do specifically with Omni's financial situation, bank statements, and specifically going to the issue of whether it had sufficient financial wherewithal to close on a loan had it received loan approval in mid-June. And that, there's simply no, if you will, good explanation by the board for its refusal to consider that. The board says things like, well, that information wouldn't have been an independent basis for default, or it says further incorrectly that since it wasn't known to the contracting officer, it's not relevant. And that's simply not the case. It's been made clear repeatedly, especially in Empire Energy Management, which both sides have cited, that what the board or court considers is all the evidence that was knowable, that existed at the time of the termination. And you can also consider, especially in delay cases, you consider analyses of that evidence, even if the analyses were prepared after the termination. But what's important is whether the evidence was in existence, not whether anyone from the agency knew it. And that's crystal clear from Empire Energy. The other argument we have with respect to the termination for default clause is echoes what the dissenter says, Judge Virgilio says in dissent below, which is that the board, while quoting the proper standard from Lisbon and its progeny, didn't actually apply that Lisbon statement. And we recognize that it's a challenge to argue that, but we're saying no more than what the dissent says. And the factor here is it's difficult to quote sufficiently at length to be immune from the charge of taking something out of context. But if you do read the board's entire analysis, what the board is doing, rather than deciding whether it was reasonable, whether a reasonable person could have concluded as of the termination date that there was no reasonable likelihood of completion, the board is in fact looking back and deciding whether it thinks, in fact, there was a reasonable likelihood of conclusion, of completion, time of completion. And it's clear from the board's discussion, and the board also, relatedly, focuses on the subjective views of the contracting officer. And so the board's findings ultimately are, well, we think that Omni could have started as late as August 5th, which is the date that no one had mentioned or proposed in mid-year. And that the contracting officer had no reason not to wait to see a few more days, a week or two, to see if Omni would have received its financing. But those are not tests that are relevant, really, to the Lisbon test.
But it is relevant, isn't it? You have a time is of the essence clause that's constantly waived or ignored, and then at a stage in which you're told that just another few days and everything will be under control to terminate. If anything, it does support the shift to termination for convenience, does it not, rather than default at that stage?
Well, those may be relevant factors, but the important thing is that there's no argument here on appeal that the completion date had been waived. The completion date, December 31st, was in effect.
It's a factor, but as to where did the board go wrong?
Where the board went wrong is, if you look in the analysis, what the board is doing is, rather than saying, could a reasonable contracting officer have concluded as of this date, knowing what we now know, everything that was knowable at that time, that there was no likelihood of, reasonable likelihood of completion, what the board does instead is look back and says, well, let's figure out whether we think there was a reasonable likelihood of conclusion. The board makes a number of findings sort of in Omni's favor, that probably would have gotten the financing, then it probably would have closed properly, then it would have gotten the permits, etc. And the board concludes, well, we think Omni could have finished, therefore no reasonable person in mid-June could have thought otherwise. It's that last step that doesn't make sense. The last step, a reasonable person looking at what was known in June, that Omni had never yet performed anything on time, and it had repeatedly promised that it would soon have financing, still hadn't gotten it, had missed yet another date that it had just recently promised that it would make the start of construction, et cetera, the types of things listed in the dissent. That's the perspective, that's the proper perspective to be looking at this from. And we've suggested, certainly, that it comes down to whether these facts add up to a conclusion that someone could have been reasonable to conclude in June that this contractor, which had not yet performed on time and had yet missed yet another date and had no financing, whether there was only a minimal chance that it would complete on time.
So what is your position, that there should have been no recovery or that damages should have gone the other way?
That there should have been, no, that the termination for default should have been sustained either on the basis of the repudiation basis I discussed earlier or on the basis that, given all these facts add up to facts upon which a reasonable person, setting aside the subjective views of this contracting officer, whether you think she should have waited more days, but on the date of the termination, a reasonable person could have looked at these facts and could have concluded, given the history of the contractor, the known financial problems, etc., that there was no reasonable likelihood that the government would have this office space in fewer than 6 months, in effect, by December 31st. And that's so with respect to the evidentiary issue, the board's disregard for that certain financial evidence, that appears to warrant a remand no matter what, unless the court agrees with us with respect to the repudiation. But on this issue, there is that evidentiary issue at the threshold that would require reconsideration under using the proper evidence. But beyond that, we think that even if you look at the evidence that the board looked at, it adds up to a reasonable basis for someone to conclude that this contractor would not deliver on time. I see I'm okay. Close to my rebuttal time.
You are? Thank you, Mr. Chadwick. Mr. Black.
Good morning. Please support. I'd like to start by pointing out on damages that this case is not unprecedented. This court has a really on-point precedent, Energy Capital, that we cited in our brief. And this is a situation like Energy Capital where the government terminated a contract before performance could begin. And it's in Energy Capital, the contract was a contract for the contractor to run a loan program for HUD. And it was supposed to originate $200 million of loans over a three-year period. And there were a number of steps, of course, before any of those loans could be issued to owners of HUD properties. Analyses had to be performed. First mortgagees had to agree to waive certain rights. And so there were a lot of contingencies in the performance of that contract in Energy Capital. And the government terminated the contract unlawfully before the loan company could start performance. And this court affirmed the Court of Federal Claims ruling that the performance of all of those loans and the profits that would have been made on all of those loans was not barred by the collateral undertakings clause. That what you've got to look at is what is going to flow directly from the performance of the contract. What is the result of the immediate and direct fulfillment of the contract? In Energy Capital, even though there were a lot of contingencies, this loan company was going to make $200 million worth of loans and was going to make about 2% interest on all those loans, which was its lost profit. In this case, Omni was going to build a building under this lease. It was clearly contemplated in the lease. The government got to review the construction plans. Government knew that Omni had to finance the building. Omni was going to build a building, lease it to the government. The government was going to rent it for 10 years, and then at the end of the lease, Omni was going to own this building. During the course of the lease, Omni was going to pay off its mortgage and own the building free and clear at the end of the lease. So just as this court affirmed in Energy Capital, it's permissible. The Omni's expectancy damage, the immediate and direct result of the fulfillment of this lease, was its ownership of equity in the building at the end of the lease. So this case is not without precedent. And I should point out that there are factual findings that are entitled to deference that the board made explaining how financially this lease was supposed to work for Omni and what Omni's expectations were. And the board pointed out that Omni had two expectations. One was a stream of rent payments, and the other was accruing equity in the building over the lease as it used the rent payments to pay off the mortgage. And in this case, it turned out that because Omni was using its mortgage, the rent to pay off the mortgage, and the way it had priced the contract, it was basically a no profit on the rent payments, but Omni was going to be accruing equity, and that was its profit. That's what it was going to own at the end of this lease. That was the natural result of...
Didn't the board find there were not accrual damages like in energy?
And that concerns Omni's cross-appeal. And that's sort of our argument, that when the board was considering the impact of the collateral undertakings doctrine, it made the factual findings that the equity was accruing over the course of the lease. And in fact, those factual findings are on pages 64 and 65 of its decision. This is what the board found. The reversionary value of the property was the equity Omni would have owned at the end of the lease. Through payment of debt service, Omni would have been building equity in the building. Omni's return on this lease would be both from the income in the lease and the equity that would follow. There would have been profit and value in the building that Omni would have owned essentially free and clear at the end of the lease. And here's the kicker. Had the project been completed, Omni would have secured a return on its money through the return of equity due to payment of its debt service. Its ultimate return and profit was thus the ownership of the building. How do you accrue equity? You pay the principal of the mortgage, 10-year mortgage. You know, these were the facts. And so this was accrual damage, and that was the one error the board made when it was determining when to discount damages, which date was appropriate for discounting. It should have been consistent, just as it had treated the equity in Omni's building as accrual damages in its earlier analysis. It should have been consistent in that analysis, applied the same facts it found, or applied the law to the same facts it found. These are accrual damages. In Energy Capital, this court clearly held that accrual damages are different from other kinds of damages, and that instead of determining damages from the date of the breach, you determine them as they go along in the contract, and then if there's any that were, to the extent they were accrued after the date of judgment, you discount back to the date of judgment. And that was the error that Omni's asserting in its cross-appeal, which is very easy to correct. It's a mathematical calculation.
What about the risk factor involved, though, that the board found required discounting to the date of breach?
Well, the risk factor had to go in with the discount rate, and that's a 13% discount rate, and we don't appeal that a risk-based discounting rate was appropriate in this case. Instead, it's if there are accrual damages, you're supposed to discount to the date of judgment. So the board did factor in risk in the discount rate, and we don't disagree with that on appeal. Regarding the adequate assurances provided by Omni, I think it's one of the things that's important to point out up front is that the board found as a fact that Omni actually was offering more assurances, and the government basically cut off Omni and said, we don't want to hear anymore. And this is a fact that is on page 22 of the board's decision. where the board is finding facts. Omni's attorney, a fellow named Duncan Steadman, called the contracting officer, it was the day before the termination, and he asked the contracting officer what documentation could he help her get, and what could he do to reassure her on the issues that she had raised. And Mr. Steadman testified, and the board found his testimony credible. That's an important finding, it's expressly in there. That the contracting officer refused his offer, and she said, no, we're going to terminate, so we don't need anything. So, unlike almost any other adequate assurances case, here you've got the complaining party saying, we don't want any more assurances, and then on appeal, they're saying, where's the beef? Where was your...
But what are you asking us to make of that? There were delays, and there were extensions, and there were setbacks.
Right.
That...
Well, I think
the weight that the contracting officer gave to them, apparently, by that point, were quite large.
Well, on the issue of assurances, I would ask the court to find that legally, what Omni did provide was sufficient assurances. Omni, through its Mr. Quayle and its attorney, had phone calls with the contracting officer and a letter that detailed, laid out in detail, its commitment to the lease and its plan for performing on time. And some of the financing obviously was a concern to the contracting officer. The information that Omni presented to the contracting officer was corroborated by the financing company itself. Mr. Pitcher of Equitable Insurance had communications with the contracting officer and her representative, and his information confirmed what Omni was telling the government, that it had a viable plan, that the loan was before the loan committee, that Mr. Pitcher had recommended approval, a decision was pending in a few days. If that decision came, Omni had plenty of time to get started on time in early July to finish on time. And it's worth keeping in mind, this is a contract where Omni still had more than 100% of the time left for performance to do less than 100% of the work. Because Omni, again, these are found facts, in November of 1996, Omni had actually started doing some of the grading and had gotten a head start, because it had gotten permission from the city. So, getting back to adequate assurances, the government is entitled to reasonable assurances, and that's exactly what Omni provided, a detailed plan that was corroborated by other sources. The contracting officer could have checked up on the status of the building permit with a simple call. She chose not to do that, but she was capable of verifying.
Now, we're reviewing the board here, not the CO's action, right?
That's correct. And and
we defer to the board on fact questions, substantial evidence questions, deference. And the fact question is whether there was reasonable basis for a conclusion that the building would have been completed on time.
Okay, and that's sort of shifting to the Lisbon standard away from adequate assurances. And here, if you read the board's decision, it's very detailed, very thorough. The Lisbon standard is trumpeted in numerous times throughout the analysis. Lisbon requires the government, the burden is on the government to prove that there is a reasonable basis for finding that there is no reasonable likelihood of time of performance. And all this board did was follow Lisbon to a T and put the burden on the government to prove a reasonable basis. And the conclusion, after considering all the evidence, was that the government had failed its burden. The board applied the standard correctly, the right weight to the evidence. And it's worth keeping in mind that terminations for default are unlike almost any other governmental action. Most governmental actions, when they come up to a judicial body, they're entitled to a presumption of correctness, and the burden is on the contractor to show that there was an error. And again, with terminations for default, they don't get that presumption of correctness sort of coming into the board. The burden remains on the government to prove that what it did was correct. Again, if you read the opinion, it's well-reasoned, very thorough. It went through the analysis. The board just held that the government didn't meet its burden, and that was proper application of the standard. I do want to point out, discuss this expert opinion testimony that the board decided was not proper to conclude. A couple of points that I'd like to reinforce on that was that this evidence, the board was considering evidence that was known to the contracting officer, and would consider evidence not known to the contracting officer if it would provide an independent ground for determination. And that's where this court's case law has been. And the evidence we're talking about was post-termination opinion about the strength of Omni's loan application. The underlying loan application was before the board. There was a lender that declined that loan application. That was before the board. All the board decided was not to consider was this independent post-termination opinion that did not... Omni was not contracting to provide, to have a strong loan application. It was contracting to build a building. So this was not an independent ground for protest, ground for default. And so it was proper to exclude that. A couple other things I'd point out on that point. Number one, the government did argue the exact opposite position below. I'd like to quote from its brief on this point, just to, that in its post-hearing brief, which is on A4988, the government below was telling the board, trying to exclude some of Omni's evidence, that the board should not consider facts unknown to the CO in assessing her reasonable belief. McDonnell Douglas, this is a quote, McDonnell Douglas recognizes that a CO's reasonable belief at the time of termination can only be based upon facts known to her at that time, regardless of facts which surface later. And now up on appeal, the government is arguing the opposite. This expert opinion analysis surfaced later, and it now wants that before the board. Now it claims the board should have considered it, despite what it argued to the board below. Lastly, there is a harmless error aspect of this too. The board did consider this evidence when it was assessing damages, because Omni had the burden of proving its damages, and so it did consider the likelihood that Omni could have gotten a loan. And this evidence was considered, and the board held that it did not change its assessment that Omni would likely have gotten, secured the financing it needed to build the building. So it just wouldn't make much difference under the Lisbon analysis. We sort of know what the outcome would be even if the board had considered this. So I have about 1 minute left. I'd like to reserve that for rebuttal if I could.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Black.
On the cross appeal.
On the cross appeal.
Yes.
If there's something to rebut.
Yes.
Mr. Chadwick.
May it please the court. Thank you. Two or three quick things with respect to damages. We, of course, cited Energy Capital in our own brief. The key distinction there is that the purpose of the contract in Energy Capital was for that contractor to make the loans from which the income would afloat. The purpose of this lease was for the government to pay money to get office space. This was not, as counsel once said, this was not even a contract to build a building. This was just a contract for the office space. It happened that Omni was building a building to provide it. The loss there, then, is the loss of the rental income. That is the entire focus and topic of the contract. With respect to damages, again...
Was the reversionary interest foreseeable?
In a pragmatic sense, perhaps, but it's not...
Doesn't that bring it within most damages calculations?
No, because it's still consequential. It's still within the rule that says if there is a transaction that's one or two or three steps removed from the contract before you, for instance, paying off my own mortgage probably depends on my continuing to receive a salary, but it doesn't. That's foreseeable, but that's not a legal relationship. But
the government continued to give extensions. I mean, that's really significant, isn't it? Despite the contract terms, and then all of a sudden said no more.
Well, it's significant to a point, except that no one disputes that the December 31st date held, completion date. Secondly, we have a unanimous finding by the board, which hasn't been challenged, that the government did have reasonable grounds to issue the cure notice at the time it did in June. So at that point, it becomes a somewhat different situation. If there's a reasonable grounds for a cure notice, that does trigger responsibilities, and there is an undisputed December 31 completion date. So the responsibility to the contractor to respond at that point is acute. We're the appellee with respect to the damages appeal. We've simply asked if there's going to be any adjustment in damages that the court bear in mind the $20,000 deduction that should have been made to the damages and affirm on other grounds if there's any change. Again, with respect to repudiation, the last argument is, again, as counsel described it, there were no facts presented to the AG, simply promises.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chadwick. Mr. Black, do you have something to tell us?
Just a few moments. With regard to the government's argument that the $20,000 loss that Omni would have realized, that should be factored into if you make adjustments, that should have been another appeal by the government, and it didn't include that in its any appeal. So
no, we're on your cross-appeal only.
Right, and so it's not timely to raise that in rebuttal to our cross-appeal. And then I point out that in regard to our cross-appeal, the government really didn't say anything in opposition to it in its brief. I'll just end with that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Black. Thank you both. The case is taken under submission.